Okay, we're recording. So, in this chapter we're going to cover black holes. This will spill over into the final lecture. I may not get through everything in chapter 7. I kind of owe you a lecture because I missed one when I was ill, but it doesn't look as if there's any slots that we can use. Certainly not going to suggest that we have the extra lecture in April after the Easter holidays. So I think we maybe just have to run with the 10. We might just get to the end of chapter 7 anyway, but anything that falls off the end of chapter 7 obviously will not be examinable. But I don't want to miss too much of the black holes out. There's a few things that I've never made examinable, but they're really interesting. And they merit at least a brief discussion, and again, the aims and objectives I've put up will make clear what I expect you to be able to do and what I don't expect you to be able to do. But I've introduced, for the first time in these notes, a short section on Hawking radiation, and I would like to cover that, but we certainly won't today. That'll be in the next lecture. So we're first of all just going to do a straightforward discussion of the general relativity view of a black hole. Hawking radiation goes beyond that and starts to look at ideas of where you might include quantum physics. The general relativity view of a black hole is actually very simple. A Schwarzschild black hole is described really just by a single number, its mass. It's static, it's not rotating, so it's not really doing anything else very interesting. It's just slowly but surely sucking the rest of the universe inside its event horizon. So what we're going to cover today is a discussion of what exactly we mean by the event horizon and what would happen to a material particle or a photon as you approach the event horizon. And then what we'll go on to discuss in the final lecture is just a little bit of elementary material about a rotating black hole, what we call a Kerr black hole. And the important point about Kerr black holes, which I hope to demonstrate, is that when the black hole rotates, it kind of effectively drags space-time round with it, what we call frame dragging. And this means that if you launch a particle towards a rotating black hole, and it's got zero angular momentum to begin with, it will acquire angular momentum, it will actually be carried round, it will wind up moving in a circular orbit. Well, in fact not a circular orbit, it will spiral in, but it will gain angular momentum. So that's the key result that we'll derive next time, but for today we're just going to stick to static black holes. So actually, we start off just looking at the same Schwarzschild metric that we looked at for weeks earlier in the course. We looked at the Schwarzschild metric for about four lectures, first of all deriving it and then looking at tests of it. So equation 6.1, reproduced again here, hopefully is quite familiar to you now in the form of it. But the important point that is the launch-off point for our discussion of black holes is to note that when R equals 2m, the metric misbehaves. So we remarked on that when we were doing chapter 3, but we just moved on because we said, well, let's not worry about that because the radius of a real star is so much bigger than 2m that you would never be applying the Schwarzschild metric to the space-time around a real star where R equals 2m, because actually you'd already be inside the physical surface of the star and you'd have to use a different metric anyway. You'd have to use the metric that we discussed in chapter 4 for the interior structure of a star. But even in chapter 4 we got quite close to R equals 2m. We said that you could have a neutron star, for example, with a radius of 9m over 4, only very slightly more than 2m. You couldn't make the radius any smaller than that, because if you did, you would need an infinite central pressure to support it. But you can get close to R equals 2m. Now what we're going to consider is what happens if you actually go all the way to R equals 2m. So we can see, for starters, as I'd remarked in chapter 3 as well, that strange things are going to happen, because dr squared over 1 minus 2m over r, well, that's going to go infinite, it's going to diverge because the denominator will go to zero. And the coefficient of dt squared is also going to go to zero. So just for the moment, let's, file that fact away and say, strange things happen at r equals 2m. But as we'll see in a moment, it's actually just really a kind of a mathematical problem. It's not a genuine physical issue. The equations misbehave, but as we'll see, the physical nature of what's going on is nothing to get too alarmed about. I've got an analogy in a couple of pages' time, which will maybe explain rather better what I mean by it just being a mathematical problem rather than a physical one. But already we can see that once you go inside R equals 2m, assuming for the moment that there's, you know, that it is possible to consider such radii, then we can see that even stranger things happen in a way, because time-like intervals become space-like and space-like become time-like. We want to discuss that as well in this chapter. Okay, so all I've really been doing in these last few minutes is giving you a sort of brief verbal summary of the material that's described in 6.1 in a slightly different order, but the basic points are all there. 6.2 is really just there to make those who've done Astronomy 1 feel slightly warm and fuzzy, because hopefully you'll remember the Stellar Physics 2 lectures, if not the warmth, at least the fuzzy bit, because the Stellar Physics 2 was all about using the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, the fundamental fuzziness of quantum particles, to kind of generate a source of pressure, which actually isn't warm at all, it's cold pressure. It can be associated with an object that's not generating any thermal heat, but instead is getting the pressure just from degeneracy. None of that's examinable in this course. I mean, it's a fascinating topic in itself, but it's got nothing very much to do with relativity. It's all to do with quantum physics. It's covered, well, it used to be covered, let me see, wistfully, and to a limited extent in some of the other astronomy courses, but I think it's kind of dropped off the radar a bit in the Stellar Physics Astro course. But it's interesting stuff. It's basically how you arrive at a physical prediction of how small white dwarfs are, how small neutron stars are. But like I say, we're actually going beyond all that. We're going to even denser and more massive objects, which are so dense and massive that they won't be stopped in their gravitational collapse by quantum degeneracy pressure. If that's the case, then you've got yourself a black hole candidate. So again, we can largely skip over 106. Really, it's the bit that's just up at the top of the screen now. Having set the scene and described the things that we're not going to cover in this course, what we're going to cover instead is stellar remnants that have got masses greater than about twice the mass of the Sun. And if that's the case, then even this neutron degeneracy pressure that those who did E1 might remember will not be sufficient to stop the collapse. And according to general relativity, at least, nothing can stop the collapse. You've got yourself then a black hole. So, does this really happen in nature? Well, as I've said, really nobody does know for sure, but I think if you did a poll of cosmologists and astrophysicists, most people would probably take the view that something stops there being actual singularities in nature. It just sort of goes against the grain to think that there could be regions of space-time where the density is actually infinite. You know, what does that really mean? How can you have infinite quantities in finite space-time? So I suppose what most people would say, and I would firmly endorse this, is that something must stop a black hole collapsing all the way down to R equals zero. We just don't know what that is yet. So where is a white dwarf and a neutron star will be stopped by quantum electron and quantum neutron degeneracy pressure? That's not enough to stop a black hole from collapsing, but maybe something else is. Maybe something to do with quarks or superstrings or aspects of particle physics that I certainly don't understand, and I suppose nobody does yet. But as far as general relativity is concerned, nothing stops the collapse until you get to R equals zero, by which time you've got a point of infinite density that we call a singularity. But like I said a few minutes ago, strange things have already happened when you look at the Schwarzschild metric when you cross R equals 2m. So we have two issues to discuss. One is, what happens at r equals 0? And secondly, what happens at r equals 2m? So according to general relativity, at r equals 0, you've got infinite density and pressure. But at r equals 2m, you don't really have anything to give a physicist nightmares. But what you do have is a mathematical singularity. So what do I mean by that? Well, this is where the analogy might be helpful. Think about the Earth. Think about the North and South Pole of the Earth. The coordinate system that we choose to use on the surface of the Earth basically breaks down at the North and South Pole, because all the lines of constant longitude converge and meet at a point. So our choice of coordinate system renders those two points to be singular in a mathematical sense. But, as I say in the next page, aside from the obvious fact that they're a bit cold, there isn't really anything physically different about those two locations compared with anywhere else on the surface of the Earth. If you chose to, you could define the equator to be somewhere else, maybe give it a different name, define your coordinate system according to that circle around the Earth, and then the pole would be in a different place. The poles would be in a different place. So the Schwarzschild radius, r equals 2m, is a bit like that. It's a mathematical singularity. It leads to the breakdown of the coordinate system that we use in the Schwarzschild metric. But there isn't really anything else physically that's special. Well, there is something special about the Schwarzschild radius. We'll see what that is in a minute. But as you cross the Schwarzschild radius, you wouldn't suddenly be, you wouldn't suddenly evaporate or be squashed to a pulp. When you get to r equals 0, on the other hand, according to general relativity, then you've got problems. But when you cross the Schwarzschild radius, you might almost say that you wouldn't notice. Okay? Right. Enough chit-chat. Let's get on with some maths now, because we're going to see how this comes about. So we're going to demonstrate that r equals 2m is just a mathematical singularity by considering a particle falling towards a black hole. And we're going to see that it gets to r equals 2m in a proper time that's perfectly finite, and there's nothing really untoward about the expression that we derive. Okay, so let's suppose that the particle is released from rest at coordinate time t equals 0 and proper time tau equals 0 in the particle's rest frame. So we'll just synchronise our clocks. And then the question we're going to ask is, how much proper time elapses between the particle being released and the particle reaching the Schwarzschild radius? Okay? So the equations we need are the ones that we had in chapter 3. So there was the equation for the radial motion of a particle moving in the Schwarzschild metric. Dr by dt squared equals a bunch of stuff, which we subsequently used in chapter 3 to derive the predictions of Gr, like the advance of perihelion of Mercury, came out of our solution to equation 6.2. Well, what we're going to do is, we're going to assume that the particle is thrown towards the black hole radially. Now, this is a static black hole, so we've got none of this frame dragging stuff to confuse the issue. That happens with a rotating black hole. If it's a static black hole and you throw in the particle with zero angular momentum, it's moving along a radial path, it will just follow a radial path. So that means that we can take d phi by d tau to be zero. In other words, h is 0, and that also simplifies equation 6.2. So the equation we've got to solve is dr by d tau squared is k squared minus 1 plus 2m over r. Now let's suppose that the particle is released from radius capital R. It's released from rest, so initially dr by d tau equals 0. So that means that k squared minus 1 has to be minus 2m over capital R. capital R is just a constant. So we could write instead 6.6, dr by d tau squared is 2m over small r minus 2m over capital R. And when we take the square root, if we take account of the fact that we're choosing to throw the particle in towards the black hole, it's moving radially inwards, so proper time is going to be positive, but dr is going to be negative, because you're throwing it from a bigger radius to a smaller radius. Therefore, we stick a minus sign on, we take the minus square root, and that will guarantee that the elapsed proper time is positive. Okay? With me so far? So the particle's falling from R equals capital R to R equals 2m. And we want to work out what is the elapsed proper time that the particle experiences. The proper time, remember, is the time it would measure if it was wearing a wristwatch in its frame, in its rest frame. So delta tau is the integral from capital R to 2m of minus dr over the square root term, but we just flip the limits of the integral round, get rid of the minus sign, and it turns into 6.8. Now, we're not going to work out what the integral is, but we're just going to note that it's finite, because as r tends to 2m, 2m over r, 2m over small r, just tends to 1. So there's nothing in that integral that would cause the proper time to misbehave, to diverge, to become infinite or anything like that. Okay? So the particle will reach the Schwarzschild radius in a finite proper time. So as far as the particle's concerned, there's nothing strange affecting its trajectory as it moves towards the Schwarzschild radius. The interesting feature is what happens when you consider instead the coordinate time. So the coordinate time is just the value of t, not tau. The proper time takes proper account of the curvature of space-time, whereas t is just a label attached to points in space-time with different coordinates. However, remember, when you're far away from the mass, then space-time, described by the Schwarzschild metric, reduces to Minkowski spacetime, in which case the proper time will match the coordinate time. So it will for a stationary particle. So if you've got someone who's very far away from the black hole, looking as this particle falls towards it, then basically the proper time that that second observer would measure should just be the same as the coordinate time, because they're so far away from the Schwarzschild black hole that the capital M over R, small r for them, is very large. Okay? So let's work out that's why we're trying to work out the interval of coordinate time, because it's going to be relevant to a distant observer looking at what happens as the first particle falls in. Okay? So let's work it out. So dt by d tau, equation 3.8 a long time ago, is that equation k over 1 minus 2m over r. We now know what k is. We can rewrite that then as the square root of 1 minus 2m over capital R divided by 1 minus 2m over small r. And then we can do a bit of further rearrangement, replacing d tau by dr using equation 6.7, and we get 6.10. And then we have to integrate that. We do the same trick. We get rid of the minus sign by flipping round the integral limits from 2m to capital R of that rather hideous expression 6.11. Again, we won't bother working out what the integral is, but what we'll notice is that the integral diverges as R tends to 2m, because as R tends to 2m, 2m over R tends to 1, you've got a 1 minus 1, which is 0, and therefore you've got a 0 in your denominator, which is never a good thing. And to be strictly true, it doesn't necessarily follow that the integral diverges, but it does in this case. So this is also true for a photon. I mean, what we did was we took the proper time as our what we call the affine parameter, the parameter that, that is measuring the distance along the trajectory. For a photon, we'd have to use something else. Like, for example, when we talked about light deflection, we would use an angle round the trajectory. Shouldn't wave my hand about when I've got my microphone, but I'm sure it'll still pick it up. So basically, what this tells us, if we think what this actually means, delta t is the interval of time that a distant observer would measure, because coordinate time for them should match the proper time. Therefore, what you're saying is that to a distant observer, it will look as if it's taken the particle that's falling into the black hole an infinite amount of time to reach the event horizon. So it will look to that distant observer as if the particle never gets there. But it does, because the proper time measured by the particle itself is finite. It's just the view that the distant observer gets is that the particle gets kind of frozen as it approaches the event horizon. So crucially, what this demonstrates is that the misbehaviour of the Schwarzschild metric at r equals 2m might be an issue for a distant observer, but it's not an issue for the particle itself as it falls in. In just the same way as somebody mucking around with latitude and longitude will find that some formulae will break down when you consider the North Pole, because it's a mathematical singularity in your coordinate system, but it hasn't stopped people going to the North Pole. So it's the same basic idea. There's no fundamental physical reason why you can't reach and indeed pass the event horizon. But to a distant observer, they'll never see you get there. Okay? Probably at the beginning of next lecture, we'll discuss an alternative coordinate system. Might have time to do it today, depends how we get on. An alternative coordinate system which does make more sense. It allows you to consider crossing the Schwarzschild radius without funny things happening, because it gets round this mathematical singularity. So to kind of extend that point further, to summarise what I'm getting at, that really the physical consequences for a particle or photon crossing the Schwarzschild radius, r equals 2m, are nothing much. An astronaut who's free-falling in a spaceship towards the black hole wouldn't be aware of any sudden dramatic change when you cross the Schwarzschild radius. The laws of physics are still going to apply just the same. And in the astronaut's local inertial frame, the results of any experiment should still agree with the predictions of special relativity. Crossing the Schwarzschild radius does, however, have consequences for the eventual fate of the astronaut. We'll see that in a minute. But there isn't a sudden change in the laws of physics as you cross the Schwarzschild radius. They apply just the same at and beyond the Schwarzschild radius as they do outside. I have put a little footnote in, though, because you should not interpret what I've just said about the consistency of the laws of physics as you cross the event horizon as in any way an endorsement of, you know, the future sport of diving into black holes. I don't imagine that would be a major tourist industry of the future, but it would be a fairly short-lived one, because depending on the mass of the black hole, it's still a very hazardous experience. It's not the crossing of the event horizon per se that's the problem. Well, it is if you want to get back, but see, we'll get to that in a minute. The real problem is the tidal forces being so large. So before you even get anywhere near the Schwarzschild radius, because the gravitational pull on your feet would be so much more than the gravitational pull on your head, then the technical term spaghettification has been proposed to describe what would happen to such an astronaut. But the point here is that the curvature and the tidal forces depends on the mass. So if you had a massive enough black hole, then the tidal forces wouldn't be so severe. If, for example, you found yourself a supermassive black hole at the centre of a galaxy, then crossing its event horizon would be a much more genteel process, because the tidal forces aren't nearly so severe, because it's a much more massive body. To put it another way, as I've said there, the strong principle of equivalence says that locally, space-time should be locally flat, everything should reduce to what special relativity would predict. But how local is local? If it's the case that the gravitational field is so strong that a locally inertial frame can only meaningfully be defined on a scale that's much smaller than the size of the astronaut, then that becomes a problem. Around the Earth, for example, if you think back to Norman's course, you can define a local inertial frame as like a falling lift, because the Earth's gravitational field isn't strong enough to make the curvature effects and the tidal forces noticeable on the scale of the size of a lift. But if you're close to a black hole, then as I said, feet to head, there's a big differential in the tidal force, you would know about it. And it's no good saying you could just lie sideways as you fall into the black hole, because it would still get you in the end. But the main point is that that's not to do with the event horizon itself, it's to do with the tidal forces. And actually getting too close to a neutron star could be pretty nasty in the same way anyway. Okay? So the Schwarzschild radius itself doesn't kill you. It's the tidal forces that do. Okay. However, crossing the Schwarzschild radius still does have profound consequences. So let's look at that next. So as I've said at the top of this page, there's quite a lot of words in this chapter. Maybe you're not too disappointed about that after all the thousands of equations in the earlier chapters. But you know, I'm just picking out a few highlights here. I want you to read these for yourself as well. And you know, you can rest assured that at least part of a question, if you get a question about black holes, will invite you just to discuss stuff rather than to prove formulae. I mean, some people don't like those kind of questions. What? You mean I've got to write some English? But nonetheless, in a way, they're quite appropriate for this topic, because it's a real test of whether you've understood the concepts rather than being able to do integration and all that sort of stuff. So after you've crossed the Schwarzschild radius, bottom line, according to general relativity, is that it's impossible to get back out again. So let's see why. In fact, you can't even remain at a fixed radius. What happens is that all trajectories inevitably carry you to a smaller radius, so you're inevitably and inexorably drawn towards the singularity at the centre. And R equals zero is a true physical singularity according to general relativity of infinite density. Although, as I said earlier, I suppose most astrophysicists would say, well, something will stop it becoming infinite, but it's going to be something on the scale of superstrings or the Planck length, so I wouldn't really expect that's going to be much consolation if you're in your spaceship heading towards the centre of the black hole. And once you're inside the Schwarzschild radius, you can't even send a message, not even a single photon, to explain what's happening to your friends outside. So let's see if we can understand why that should be. So we've got some figures to help illustrate this, but just before we get on to the figures, we'll go back to the Schwarzschild metric again and see if we can make sense of it from that. So ds squared measures the interval between two neighbouring events. So we label those t, x, y, z, and t plus dt, x plus dx, y plus dy, z plus dz. And this is all stuff that is first introduced, I suppose, in courses on special relativity. So I'm just going to recap the basic ideas. That a null interval is one for which ds equals zero. A space-like interval is one for which ds squared is greater than zero, the way I've defined the signature of the metric. And a time-like interval is one for which ds squared is less than zero. Okay? So if the interval is space-like, that means you can find some frame in which the events occur at the same time, i.e. dt equals zero. And if the interval is space-like, if ds squared is greater than zero, then the two events can't therefore lie on the world line of a material particle. So let's think why that should be. Well, we've said that if the interval is space-like, you can find a Lorentz frame in which the events occur at the same coordinate time. So if the two events are on the world line of the same material particle, then that means that there's another observer in Lorentz frame S prime who effectively would see the same particle in two places at once. And that's not allowed according to general relativity. It would violate causality. Now, whether quantum physics rules that out is another matter, and it's beyond really my level of understanding, but I read about the experiments that are being undertaken to sort of teleport electrons around labs and things. It's pretty clear that quantum physics doesn't play with the same rules, but here we're restricting ourselves to what GR allows, and according to GR, this would not be possible. You couldn't have the same material particle lying in two places on its world line separated by a space-like interval, because if you could, then there would be some observer that would see the particle in two places at once. Okay? Now, what that's got to do with black holes can be seen in the next wee bit. Suppose you've got a particle inside the event horizon, and let's suppose that the particle's at rest. So let's optimistically assume that once you're inside the event horizon, you could just sit there. Even better, you could try to escape, but at least let's see if you could just stay at the same radius. So we're going to consider neighbouring events, and we've got dr, because remember, it's at rest. Well, actually, that's not relevant yet. We'll get to that. Dr d theta d phi will take all to be 0, and we'll take dt to be different from 0. So from equation 6.1, if you go back to the original Schwarzschild metric, you're now going to have ds squared is minus 1 minus 2m over r times dt squared. So because r is less than 2m, ds squared is greater than 0. So the interval between the events is positive. Therefore, these two events can't lie on the world line of the particle. So what we've tried to do is to put a particle inside the event horizon, say that it's at rest, and consider two events separated by non-zero coordinate time. But because the coordinate time behaves in a different way inside the event horizon, that is ruled out by causality violation, because it would require the interval between those two points to be space-like. Effectively, what's going on is the intervals that behave as space-like outside the event horizon really behave like time-like intervals inside the event horizon, and vice versa. And what that means in physical terms is that just as in the exterior space-time outside the event horizon, you can move freely through space, but you're not free to move in time. And you can't just decide that time's going to stand still. It'd be very useful sometimes, of course, but it doesn't work that way. And I suppose it is one of the deep fundamental mysteries of space and time. Why does time behave in that manner, but space doesn't? Well, to further complicate matters, inside the event horizon of a black hole, it doesn't work that way anyway. Time and space, as coordinate labels, sort of behave the other way round. So you can move freely through space but not through time when you're outside the event horizon, but you can't move freely through space when you're inside the event horizon. Interestingly, and again, it's way beyond the scope of the book, of the lecture notes, But there's an interesting little book called How to Build a Time Machine, written by Paul Davis, which in a sense takes the other half of what I've just said. Inside the event horizon, if you can't move freely through space anymore, does that mean you can move freely through time? Well, he suggests that maybe you can, but you've got to do all sorts of clever things, like get yourself some exotic matter with negative pressure, find a black hole, make sure it's spinning, and then get yourself a time machine. So not really a practical Honours Lab project, I'm afraid, but an interesting subplot to all of this. And it lets you see that, you know, the line between where the science ends and the science fiction begins is actually quite blurred when it comes to black holes. But the main point is that you can't move freely through space inside the event horizon the way that you can outside the event horizon. You can't stay still, and in fact, it turns out that you've got to move inwards. I think I said that in the previous page. Yeah. Well, yeah, to see that, you just imagine what would happen if you wanted dr to be negative. The same argument would apply. Dr to be positive. The same argument would apply. So not only can't you stay still, but you can't move to larger coordinate radii. You have to move inwards. Right, I think there's just about time to talk about this transformation, which is quite, yeah, we'll be able to get through this. I'll pause for a minute, just see if there's any questions. I don't want to throw too much at you all at once, but it's all good stuff. Anything so far? Okay, well, the next thing to consider then is, if we recognise that there isn't anything fundamentally physically weird about the event horizon, other than the fact that once you're inside it, you can't come back out again, then an argument is based on the fact that it's just down to our choice of coordinate system. So can we find a different coordinate system where you don't wind up with dr squared over zero at the Schwarzschild radius? Well, the answer is yes, and it's not too difficult a transformation. In fact, some of you might have seen this in second year. I think Declan likes to drop this in at the end of the relativity course in second year, although I think it's a wee bit advanced for that. But the new time coordinate that we introduced, because remember, time coordinate is just a label, is t plus 2m times log of r over 2m minus 1. So on example sheet 2, question 5, what you've got to do is to substitute that in for t in the Schwarzschild metric. But the Schwarzschild metric doesn't involve t, it involves dt. So what you've got to do is differentiate it, do a bit of algebra, and what will pop out at the end is equation 614. So it's a new expression for the interval ds squared that now involves the coordinate radius r, but a new time coordinate. And the time coordinate is a combination of t and r. And that's quite helpful because it gets round the coordinate singularity at dr squared. Because the dr squared now doesn't have 1 minus 2m over r on the denominator. It's just got 1 plus 2m over r out front. So if we look at each of these terms, when r equals 2m, our d tau squared, that's got 0 in front. But remember, it's just a label. We're perfectly happy to talk about radially moving particles, in which case d theta squared and d phi squared equals 0. D theta and d phi is 0. The coordinate time, should we get hung up in the fact that coordinate time has got something to do with time? Not really, because we're free to define our time coordinate any way we like. We've done it in such a way that t twiddle will equal 0 at 2m over r, but we would still calculate proper times to be finite, which we'd already demonstrated anyway, but if you use this metric instead and you calculated the proper time taken to reach the event horizon, then similarly there would be no problem. But what does happen when r equals 0? the whole thing still misbehaves, because every one of the terms in the metric will have zero in the denominator, in which case ds squared will just blow up, it will misbehave. So that's consistent with our belief that, at least according to general relativity, r equals zero is a true physical singularity. Now there's a more general transformation, which is described in the Green Shoots book, Introduction to General Relativity. It's called the Kruskal-Skeres coordinates, but I've decided not to include that. I'd thought about doing it, but you know, it's more maths, but it doesn't really add anything to your physics appreciation of black holes or physical intuition about them. But if somebody wants to have a look in the book, then they're welcome to. The coordinate transformation that I have just shown you there in the previous slide has got certain attractive and I think quite instructive features, so it's just about time to show you them and then we'll stop. So remember, what you've got is an expression for the metric. If you want to find the null cones, that means the path that light would follow, you're looking for the solutions which set ds squared equals zero, because photons move along a null geodesic. So if you put ds squared equals zero, then you're invited to have a crack at this from the example sheet. What you should find is that the solutions to the previous equation for the metric are d twiddle t by dr is minus 1, or d twiddle t by dr equals 1 plus 2m over r over 1 minus 2m over r. Now I think it makes much more sense if we just look at the figure rather than me reading out the words here, because you can hopefully see what's going on. If you look at those two equations that we just described, the equations that are the solutions to the null cones setting ds squared equals zero, when you're far away from the Schwarzschild radius, we've just simplified this to be a one spatial dimension r and one time coordinate t twiddle. When you're far away from the Schwarzschild radius, then the slope is just minus 1 and plus 1 for the null cones, exactly as Minkowski space-time would predict. Let's just have a look at that again. If small r is much bigger than 2m, then d twiddle by dr in this term just equals 1. It's always minus 1 for the other solution. So that's why on the next page, the way I've tried to draw this is that the leftward sloping light cone, null cone, is always got slope of minus 1. But what happens to the other null cone, or the other side of the null cone really, is that as you approach the Schwarzschild radius, its gradient gets steeper and steeper. Okay? So, and if we look back and set r equals 2m, then d tau by dr, d tau twiddle by dr, goes to infinity. Again, nothing to get too worried about in physical terms, because all that's saying is that you've got a line that's vertical, because a vertical line has infinite gradient, just because of the way we've chosen to define the gradient. Okay? So the null cones go from Minkowski space-time-like null cones to gradually tipping over. And when you're inside the event horizon, they tip over even more. So that confirms what we had said before, that you can't stay still, you can't even move outwards, you've actually got to move inwards, because to stay still would require you to maintain the same coordinate radius as t twiddle increases, and the null cones won't let you do that. Material particles are confined to lie within the null cones, and photons will move on the null cones. So material particles can't escape, even photons can't escape. Okay, so last diagram. Can just about get this all in one page. Just to let you read the caption first of all. I know you can read it in what you've got. this is a sort of mythical spaceship, Einstein, that crosses the event horizon. There's people outside sort of sending text messages or whatever people will do in the future, and indeed food parcels. And the sequence of world lines is just to let you see what will happen. So, outside the event horizon, quite far from the event horizon, well, it's not necessarily drawn to scale, but you get the point. The slope of the world lines of the null cones is 45 degrees. So the path of a photon sent from the astronaut's friends outside, that will just go off at 45 degrees, and that will intercept the world line of the spaceship at point C. So they can still receive messages from outside, but they can't send any back outside. They can even receive food parcels, although food moving at less than the speed of light will take longer to reach them. But nothing will stop their inexorable journey towards the singularity. So on that depressing note, we should stop for today. Okay, so we've talked about just Schwarzschild black holes. Beginning of next time, we'll just look a little bit more about what you'd actually see. I mentioned earlier that it would appear to an external observer as if they never actually even crossed the event horizon, but we'll look at that a bit more carefully, see if that's really true, and then we'll talk about rotating black holes, possibly Hawking radiation if there's time. Okay, thanks very much.